The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
On Tuesday, February 12, 2008, Hazel Smith, Professor of International Relations at the University of Warwick, delivered a presentation at the Korea Society titled, North Korea, Market Opportunity, Poverty, and the Provinces. She provided data and insights into how various groups in the DPRK adapted to survive the famine of the mid-1990s.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for coming on this rather wintry day, as I think you all will be very glad that you came when you hear what our delightful guest has to say. Hazel Smith first went to North Korea in 1990. She has lived there for almost 2 years. She has been in and out of there, I think, more than 40 times. Wasn't that something you said to me? Well, at least. Anyway. I know, countless times. So she's not somebody who sort of pops in, peers around, and then peels off. She is somebody who has sunk her roots, made her friendships, and her judgments are based on months and months of contact. And she has been to many parts of North Korea, to which other people are forbidden from attending. And her interesting thesis, or one of the things she will bring out, is that under the exigencies of the terrible starvation in the mid-1990s, a lot of things went on in North Korea because there was a real breakdown of government authority and the ability of the government to function. And so the afflicted people developed all kinds of survival mechanisms which enable them to pull through. And that this has had a lasting impact on the way things work in North Korea. This is a viewpoint which I think very few people are able to convey. And I think you are all going to learn a great deal from what Hazel has to say. So without further ado, Hazel, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Don, and thank you for inviting me. Before I start, I'd just like to pass over a book which has just come out by United Nations University Press, to Don, because Don did the introduction, and I want to say, because I don't often get the chance to do it, that, and given I'm quite hard-headed, that you don't often meet and come across people who've been in government service all their lives and they still retain principle and that you feel admiration for. So I would like to pass this over to Don, because I think Don is that person. So there you are. And anybody who knows me knows I'm not a flatterer, so I can tell you it's said with some heart. I want to start to go through this quite quickly, because there's quite a lot of stuff that I want to present to you. I'm sorry if it gets a bit into the minutiae, and I apologize in advance. What I'm going to be talking about here is the start of some work that I've been doing very recently, and the title of the talk, as you can see, is Market Opportunity, Poverty, and the Provinces in North Korea. I don't have a handout for you because it's at a good draft stage, but it's not been published. But I'm very happy if anybody's interested in the work afterwards, if you leave me your card or your email after it is published. It's going out, subject to all the vagaries of peer review, in a journal called New Political Economy, to send you a copy. But at the moment, it's still under some review, and that's why I haven't got copies for everybody. What I'm going to be talking about here, if I can get the technology to work to show you, is the differential way in which marketization became embedded in North Korean society after the famine and the consequences of post-famine marketization. I'm not going to discuss at length the whole process of marketization. I talked about that in my book called Hungry for Peace, which has some flyers outside on, but I'm going to talk about what happened after that. I'm going to focus on particularly how and why provincial inequalities became embedded within this new system of marketization. I'm not arguing that provincial inequality is a surprise in itself. You'd expect in any country that there's going to be inequalities between different regions. So that's not a surprise in itself. But what I wanted to try to get at here was how and why inequality in North Korea became embedded in the way that it did after the famine and not in any other way. So that was the sort of question I set myself. And what I wanted to, what I came out with after looking through all the data that I had, and I really do welcome your feedback on this, at the end when we have question and answers, what I came out with was the surprising conclusion to me, it was surprising to me, and I've been working on the DPRK for nearly 20 years now, was that the relative deprivation between provinces is not a direct function of their relative agricultural productivity. And this was and is instead the outcome of a relationship between their comparative advantage in the provinces, including their agricultural productivity, and market opportunity. And perhaps I should say what I mean by agricultural productivity. I adopt a simple definition here, and this is the per capita cereal available to the population in each province produced in that province, produced through domestic consumption. So in other words, whether a province can feed itself through its own agricultural production. It's a very simple understanding of agricultural productivity. And the data that I use is all drawn from one source. So if it's problematic, it's probably problematic in the same way. And if you who use data will know that sometimes you can make sense out of data, even if the numbers aren't right, if you've got the same source, because you can see trends and do comparisons. And so all the data is drawn from DPRK government sources at different periods. And it all comes via different international organizations, the Food and Agriculture Organization, World Food Programme, UNICEF, and the Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance. Most of it, the basic data I use, coming from Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Programme. So that's the premise that I set out, that how to look at inequality, and the data that I'm using is based on humanitarian organizations. Not just humanitarian organization, FAO is more a monitoring organization, for instance, but data from the international organizations, which had been through some form of checks, of which, although there is in every country, in poor countries particularly, where international organizations work, some problems, at least it's more credible than most other sources of information. So I'm not going to have a big discussion about data here in DPRK. Again, I have a long discussion about data in my other work, and I'd be happy to take that up afterwards. But first of all, that's the data that I'm using. So just for those of you who are not too familiar with the way the DPRK works administratively, there's a tiered local government structure with the provinces at the top, and the counties and the city districts, which have the status of counties, next down. There were, up until late 2004, nine provinces and three cities of central authority which had the same status as provinces in the local government setup. So altogether, people used to talk loosely of 12 provinces. And so most of the data that you come across will refer to 12 administrative units at the level of the province. In late 2004, I can't find out what month, I've been trying to look for this, but in late 2004, there was some reorganization so that instead of nine provinces plus three cities of central authority for administrative purposes, you now have nine provinces plus one city of central authority. What happened was that Nampo became incorporated for administrative purposes in South Pyongan and Kaesong for administrative purposes in North Hwanghae. So by in late 2004, there was some local government reorganisation. I am going to use for my discussion here the pre-reorganisation provincial structures, but just to let you know, from late 2004, there was some reorganisation. There's also been some special status given, as I'm sure you probably know, to the areas where South Korea is involved. But overall, the provincial, then the county level, is the way that North Korea organised its local government. Below the county level, there are local units, the Ris and the Dong, but these do not have administrative authority. They're geographical units. The lowest level of administrative authority in local government is the county, and in the cities, the big cities, it's the district. And the population number, which I go by for 2005, is one that was submitted to the WFP in 2005, which is just under 23 million. Okay, so this is the first of the bits of information that I want to give you, and it shows the 10 provinces and the relative populations between them as at 2005. So you get some idea there. You can see that Chagang, the small mountainous province in the north, which is all but closed to foreigners, where there's large military bases, is one of the smallest. Rianggang, which is in the north, has lots of flatlands where potatoes are now grown in some of the counties, is also a small population province. And South Pyongan there, the second province along, I can't use this thing. This one is very big, and that's partly because in this itemization of the provinces, Nampo, which has about 800,000 people living it, is included. This is 2005. As I said, I'm just showing you this to show the current state of the provinces, but I'm actually going to use for my analysis the 12 province structure. So, which will include these 10. Plus Nampo and Kaesong. So let's get back to the theme: provincial and county differences in terms of my thesis about the relationship between market opportunity provincial inequality post the famine. First of all, I want to talk about food availability prior to the 1990s, just to set the scene. Before the 1990s, before the humanitarian organisations and the international organisations went into North Korea in a big way, there's little hard evidence pertaining to provincial and county differences in terms of poverty, in terms of agricultural productivity. There's some evidence, though, that prior to the famine of the mid-1990s, differences in life opportunities were not shaped particularly by regional provenance. There was lots of social mobility through the military, through education. And certainly we have got evidence from one nutrition survey done in 1988 by UNICEF and an Australian nutritionist, that in Kangwon, which is a poor province but has rural and urban areas, there was no significant disparity in malnutrition terms between rural and urban areas. We don't have anything for the country overall, but we see in one province there were no major disparities. Of course, the big exception would be Pyongyang, as in most capital cities, but certainly in the DPRK as well. Pyongyang was and is better off, and that's something I'm going to talk about in a minute. But I think we should be a bit careful about thinking about Pyongyang as completely a Potemkin city, because, as again I'll come to talk about later on, there are today, although it's better off than the other provinces, significant numbers of malnourished children and adults living in the city. Of course, the privileged class, as I say, around Kim Jong-il lived in Pyongyang, and I think it's no surprise that Pyongyang both then, and although I haven't got evidence for it, I have evidence for post-1990s, is the most privileged province today. So let's get on to the food supply differentials between provinces in the post-famine period. And again, I'll start by talking about some of the definitions that I'm using to assess how I'm going to assess nutrition, nutritional status. The Food and Agriculture Organization World Food Program guidelines for the basic food necessities for survival for an adult are something like 1,700 calories a day. And given that the cheapest way of providing calories is from production of basic cereals, and in North Korea's terms that means rice, maize, millet, and potatoes, cereal availability is often used by donor governments and agronomists as a proxy indicator for measuring the availability of sufficient food for survival purposes for a given population. And that's what I do, actually, in this presentation. And the rule of thumb figure used by the World Food Programme and the Food and Agriculture Organization and all the NGOs that operate in the DPRK is that for survival needs, we're looking at 167 kilograms of cereal per person per year. Now, in the post-famine period, the Food and Agriculture Organization reported that some provinces were better able to meet the basic food requirements of their populations from their own production than others. So we do have reporting at the provincial level since the famine of the mid-1990s, which does show that some provinces were better able to feed their population than others. And what I just show next in a very simple table is which provinces recovered from the famine period such as to be able to rebuild agricultural self-sufficiency, and which could not do so. Now, again, this sounds very basic, but actually in the literature on North Korea, you very rarely see anybody looking inside North Korea and having a look at patterns of distribution in terms of what's happening in agricultural terms. There's an assumption that that everything's all bad, which it is actually in aggregate terms, but not looking at the differences. So the next table shows the pattern of recovery after the famine by the different provinces. Okay, now this line here is 167 kilograms per person per year that is needed for survival for the population. And what this does is it shows, you'll see that this is the wrong way around, it should be 1999, 2000 at the top, then this, otherwise it's three consecutive years, the symbols are correct. What this shows is that only three provinces up until 2003, managed to be able to recover agricultural productivity enough, production, such as, all else being equal, they could feed their population after cereal was taken off for post-harvest losses and wastage and seed and livestock food through their own domestic production. And these were these three: South Hyege, this one, and these two here: North Hwange and North Pyongan. So this looks like a fairly stable pattern of recovery. I have figures somewhere for 2003 to 2004, but this table itself, although it looks fairly simple, took quite a lot of digging around the FAO information because it doesn't come anywhere like this. I had to find all the stats for the different provinces and the different reports and then dig them all out. So I have yet to do that job. But I would, this is guesswork now, surmise that probably we're seeing similar patterns here in terms of patterns of recovery, and that there's not going to be any major surprises. So since the famine then, we have three provinces that could, all things being equal, feed their population. No surprising results in many ways. South Hwange is the breadbasket province. If any of you have been to DPRK or travelled through it, you'll know it's all big fields and farms. And North Hwange and North Pyongan, a bit more mixed, but there's some industrial activity. We're not far behind. Ryanggang is interesting because it's one of the northern provinces, but it had benefited from massive state investment, particularly in one county called Daeyeondang, in potato production. And what the next table shows is that from 1999 onwards, the provinces established a pattern of agricultural production that, irrespective of the figures achieved per annum, reflected what I would argue is a fairly stable pattern of relative agricultural productivity between the provinces. So, you gain, all this is showing basically is the same information that we had before. We've got 100% here, so I've got percentages instead of kilograms. But this, I think, is the pattern of agricultural productivity. Well, you've got South Whangay, by far and away the best province in terms of ability to achieve feeding its population. And
where is South Whangay compared to Pyongyang?
It's south, on it's next to the South Korean border. I should have put a map up, actually. That would have been helpful.
So if you drive from Pyongyang to Panmunjom, you go through Whangay?
I don't know whether the road is through North Whangay or South Whangay. Yeah. Anybody? Okay.
And this is production. So theoretically, the government could take everything from South Whangay and move it to Pyongyang. Because the way it's now, it's like they're starving in Pyongyang. Which is obviously
I'm going to come across that. I'm going to come to that. Yeah. That's absolutely right. But... well, the first thing to show is that South Whangay has consistently recovered from the famine such that it is there. We can at least say that there is one province, and probably three, that all things being equal, could feed their populations. So what we have here is an agricultural productivity ranking per province. South Whangay at the top, North Whangay, then North Pyongan, Ryanggang, going down to Pyongyang. Pyongyang does have some farming areas in it. For those of you that have been there, will have probably been taken to a model farm if you went in the 1990s, always in Pyongyang. But not much. And that's the agricultural productivity ranking per province. So what I wanted to do was to have a look at how agricultural productivity, defined as the ability of a province to feed its own people using the 167 kilograms per person per year as the benchmark, I wanted to compare this to how the nutritional status of the provinces lined up. In other words, probably getting ahead of myself here, I wanted to have a look at whether the sort of common assumption in policymaking, international policymaking, that people were more or less all right if they're in agriculturally productive provinces and those living in the more ex-industrial areas were less all right, whether this stood up. I wanted to have a look at this assumption, which I've assumed and which most of the literature assumes. So what I do in this study is to use the extant information on the nutritional status of children under 7 years from the two international, there were three major ones, 1998, 2002 and 2004, but from the recent ones, 2002 and 2004, in terms of wasting. There are different identifications of malnutrition, and this one, wasting, is of low weight for height in children under seven. I could have used stunting, but I chose to use weighting because I felt that it was a sign of acute malnutrition and would be a useful proxy indicator to show the continuation of famine conditions in proportions of the population. Welcome Victor's remarks on this to see whether this is an appropriate methodology. And data is available for only eight of the DPRK's provinces for 2002 and 2004. So I had to narrow down the focus to make proper comparisons to those eight provinces. So what I have now, what I'm going to show you, is the nutritional status for children in terms of wasting in 2002 and 2004. Oops. And here I think you can see some interesting, the white diamonds are 2002 and the black squares are 2004. And this axis up here is the percentage of children under seven suffering from wasting. Look at the figures for South Whangay. So what I found was that rather than South Whangay's children being some of the most well-nourished in the country, I found out that, given the problems with the data, but I think this data is probably reasonably robust, that in fact there were some questions we should be asking about the nutritional status of children in these agriculturally productive provinces, which I go on to ask in this paper. And again, the next table is a simple ranking. Say 2004 is 1 to 8. As I say, I'm only using these 8 provinces because I've only got data for these 8 provinces for both these years. And of course you find that Pyongyang is best off in both those years. Then you find that South Pyongan has the best nutritional status in 2004, then North Pyongan going down to South Hamgyong. And in both years, South Hamgyong is the worst. South Hamgyong is up in the northeast, but it doesn't border China. It's not a direct border province with China, and that's consequential, as I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Again, North Hwanghae, another breadbasket province, the second of the breadbasket provinces, is here, 4 to 5. Rather than 2, which you might expect it to be, following its agricultural productivity status. So what I thought to myself, and again, this is a work in progress, so I welcome your comments on this in case I've missed something, because it seems simple, is if provincial agricultural self-sufficiency were the only or major determinant of food poverty, because I think I'm using malnutrition as an indicator of poverty, given the importance of the of simply being able to get food to live in North Korea. It's not like other countries where poverty is a mixture of all sorts of things. Food is still the most important issue for North Koreans when understanding whether they're well off or not today. But if provincial agricultural self-sufficiency were the only or major determinant of food poverty, one would expect that relative nutritional deprivation would closely follow the ranking of provinces as outlined in my earlier table, such that Pyongyang would have the worst levels of malnutrition and South Hwanghae the least nutritional problems. And of course, what I've shown you here is that there was no straightforward correspondence between agricultural productivity and nutritional status, and that the fact of being an agriculturally productive province had not much to do really with nutritional status and hence poverty outcomes. Now, what I did next was to compare provincial nutritional status across the 8 provinces for which data is available in 2002 and 2004 to those same provinces in terms of their agricultural productivity for the agricultural year 2002-2003. So Nampo, Kaesong, Kangwon and Chagang became excluded from the comparisons because I didn't have nutritional data available for those provinces for 2002 and 2004. This is where I took on board the help of a mathematician who I'll be acknowledging in this paper, started to construct a series of indices in order to try to assign a value to the comparisons between provinces. Now, I don't think I need this next section for this paper because I think the simpler data sets speak for themselves. But I'm going to go through it in case any of you are economists and because I'd welcome your feedback on this as to whether or not it does assist in this paper. But my mathematician colleague insisted that this would be a way to show the extreme disproportionalities between agricultural productivity and nutritional status, which I was finding from my looking at the data. I'm not going to go through all of it here, but I'll just say what I did so that if you want to, to talk about it afterwards or if you want me to send you this particular bit of the paper, I'd be happy to do it. First of all, what we did, actually, not what I did, we constructed an agricultural productivity index for the 8 provinces which we could use to compare against the provinces for which we had nutritional data. And we used South Hwanghae, the province with the highest per capita cereal availability for food from provincial production, as the reference province. So that was our reference province. And we then constructed an index where the other provinces were given a value compared to that index province. We then developed a nutrition index for the eight provinces in for the eight provinces in which South Hamgyong was used as a reference province, because South Hamgyong had the worst rates of wasting. I've just showed you that up there. And in terms of nutritional status, South Hamgyong was used as a reference province. We then constructed another index which provided a ratio between these two indices as a measure of the disequilibria between agricultural productivity and nutritional status for each province. And this data showed that the ratio between the indices of nutritional status and agricultural productivity, and in so doing, demonstrated disequilibria between agricultural productivity and nutritional status. I'm conscious this is minutiae, and I don't feel I need this particular section to demonstrate the point, but I'm going through it because I want to show you how I'm developing this particular paper. But what is important to me is not these technical indices which are produced, but the fact that what these indices do is that they demonstrate some research puzzles, which I then go on to talk about in the second half of the paper, and which allow us to look at the relationship between which is referred to in the title of the talk, market opportunity and poverty and the provinces. This is what the indices show. That on a value of 0 to 35, Pyongyang's right up there, of course, and crudely speaking, this means that people in Pyongyang don't produce a lot, but they eat a lot. But it skews the data so much, we've got values of 0 to 35, that what we did is that we took out Pyongyang from the equation. Oh, damn. Excluding Pyongyang, to look at the variation between the other seven provinces. And we found that in terms of the ratio between the indices of nutritional status and agricultural productivity for the seven provinces, South Hamgyong looks even more extreme in terms of its producing a lot and its people eating a lot less. So that's the technical bit, which, as I say, and you can hear from my voice, I'm not too convinced I need in this particular paper, but which I'm having an argument with my collaborator about. So what do we get on to next? Well, we certainly have some surprises, I think. But first of all, let's talk about the non-surprises. We've got some rather predictable results. Of course, not surprisingly, the data demonstrates that Pyongyang, the capital city, is consistently better off in relative terms than the other provinces. More surprising results, I think, are that North Hamgyong, generally understood in most of the literature as the worst-off province in the country in terms of agricultural productivity and the nutritional status of the population, is faring better than the common knowledge would presume. And, of course, the other surprises, which I've been pointing to throughout this short talk, is that the breadbasket provinces of South Hwanghae and North Hwanghae, the two most agriculturally productive provinces in the country, are arguably the two worst-off provinces in the country in terms of, well, not arguably, are the two worst-off provinces in terms of the relationship of nutritional status to agricultural productivity. So at least I think we can say that we've had a look at the stats, even the basic rankings and the basic data available to us, and seen that agricultural productivity and nutritional status are not congruent in the DPRK. So I hope I've demonstrated a simple point, which maybe sounds too simple, but which isn't taken for granted in the literature on the DPRK, that relative deprivation between provinces was not a direct function of their relative agricultural productivity. And so the second part of the argument of this paper is that in the post-famine period, relative deprivation between provinces was and is the outcome of the relationship between comparative advantage, including agricultural productivity and market opportunity. So I'll spend a little bit of time, a couple of minutes, talking about what I mean by marketization. North Korea is marketized, not because the population physically goes to market to purchase almost all its basic needs, which it does, but because since the famine, North Korea's economics have been governed by the laws of supply and demand. But I'm not here saying, and I'll repeat this, and I said it last time I was here, that North Korea's moves to the market have been accompanied by political liberalization. They certainly have not. And indeed, the government has spent a lot of time trying to work out ways in which it can encourage parts of the market at the same time as preventing political liberalization. However, having said that, marketization did take place in a big way after the famine, simply because the state could no longer provide, so people had to provide for themselves, and they entered into unofficial market relationships. In this process of marketization, some provinces were better placed to take advantage of the new process of processes of marketization rather than others. I would add that it's not... I'm using here the province as the key variable to analyse what's happening in North Korea, but it doesn't have to be the province as the analytical factor. You can look at social group. You can look at gender. You can look at age. You can look at counties. All I'm saying is that we can look at how different groups were better placed to take advantage of marketization and why not. So I've already suggested that the key variable in economic opportunity for North Korean citizens post the famine was not agricultural productivity of itself. So if that is the case, what was important in terms of ability of provincial populations to take advantage, to become better off or worse off, or to become less poverty-stricken or more poverty-stricken? And I think it's in those... in that spectrum, we need to think about it, because most of North Korea's population is still poverty-stricken. The question is the degree. So what I want to suggest is that there were certain non-mutually exclusive relevant variables to explain economic welfare of the provinces. An obvious one, perhaps: proximity to foreigners and consequently hard currency. And then, as I say, they overlap to a certain extent. Sometimes, the second one is the opportunities to buy and sell food. The third, the degree of party control over local populations and non-state sanctioned trading opportunities. And finally, the legitimacy of such activities. And I use these four variables and the data that I've already produced to have a look at some research puzzles which I identify as coming from this data I've presented to you. First one, why was South Hwanghae the best province in terms of agricultural production, and which at least since 1999 has produced an agricultural surplus, the second to the worst performer in terms of nutritional status of children in 2002, and had improved its ranking in nutritional status to only fourth out of the eight provinces in 2004. Another puzzle for research, why was North Hamgyong, next only to Pyongyang in its inability to feed its own population, not next in terms of nutritional indicators? Why was it slightly better off than one might have expected? Thirdly, why was South Hamgyong, similarly industrialized province to North Hamgyong, but with better agricultural productivity than North Hamgyong, consistently the worst performer in terms of nutritional indicators in 2002 and 2004? And again, it sounds simple, these sorts of questions, but I really can assure you that they're questions that haven't been asked, as far as I know, in the DPRK literature. First of all, though, I want to talk about Pyongyang. For me, Pyongyang isn't a research puzzle. It's fairly, you know, obvious that in the if you've got a capital city and a capital city in an authoritarian state, and there are small amounts of resources, they're going to be channeled to the capital, not even in an authoritarian state, probably in any other sort of state. So to me, that's not a puzzle at all. Of course, we have a radical mismatch between agricultural productivity and nutritional status. But I would like to caution against assuming an oversimplistic interpretation of the fact that Pyongyang is best off in nutritional status and worst off in agricultural status. The malnutrition figures for Pyongyang, although low, are not low in terms of the absolute numbers of malnourished children or compared to malnourished malnutrition figures from other countries in the world. In 2002, for example, 4% of Pyongyang's under-7 population suffered from wasting, and that 4% figure amounted to 14,600 young children. Of course, 14,600 is far too accurate a number, but it still gives us whether it's 15,000 or 16,000 or 12,000 or 13,000, that's a lot of children suffering from wasting, which indicates a famine-like position. And I worked in around the country, as Don said, right up until 2001. I was there last in 2003, partly because I can't get a visa these days. But up until 2001, when I was going into children's homes and schools, and Victor's been there much more recently than me, you could still see malnutrition in Pyongyang as well as you could elsewhere. And so, again, I'd warn against casting Pyongyang as somehow a perfect place to live for everybody. And again, the comparative figures are that in China, the equivalent figure for the entire country for wasting in 2002 was 1%, and for the Philippines, 6%. So let's take Pyongyang out of the equation. It's no secret and no mystery that Pyongyang is going to be the best off of all these provinces. But it is, I think it is a bit more of a mystery that South Hwanghae is so badly off in comparative terms. So let's have a look at South Hwanghae at the province. I'm sorry, I didn't bring a map. South Hwanghae in 2005 had a population of 2.3 million. I didn't look for the 2002 figures, although I do have them somewhere, but I don't think it will have changed very much over the 3 years. And the next figures are not for 2005, they're for the 2001, and they show the population figures for each county in South Hwanghae, and that's the last year for which I have data for the counties. That's 300,000 at the top. You see the big one here, Haeju City, which is the big port city in South Hwanghae. Now, of the 20 counties, the average population in South Hwanghae at 2001, the average population for the counties was 285 persons per square kilometre. This compares to an average population density for the counties in the DPRK at 2001 at 331 persons per square kilometre. And I'll show you here. So what this table shows is that the provincial population, with the exception of Haeju, is relatively evenly spread around the province, with the big exception of this urban conurbation of Hwanghae. Lots of small writing there, I apologise. What I also go on to do, and I'm switching years here, so I hope this isn't too methodologically problematic. I then went to look on at the previous data for the counties was 2001, but I had data for 2005 for the breakdown of the farming versus non-farming population. That's how North Korea classifies its people, whether they're farming or farming families or anybody else, and their families. So for 2005, for the approximately 85% of the population living in 17 of those counties that I showed you earlier, these were the 17 counties that were accessible to the international organisations, the farming population of these 17 counties was an average of just under 60% for each county. So of those counties that I showed you, for 17 of them, very, very big farming populations on average, 60% on average, which just indicates in data terms that South Hwanghae was and is a predominantly farming province with a relatively dispersed population, and again, just saying the same things another way around, largely relying on farming as its main occupation. And in fact, the data that I've shown you and that I'm talking about now underestimates the farming population for South Hwanghae, because it doesn't include the large state farming sector in Kwaeil, which is one of the counties. This is a county which is a large state farm. It produces fruit, and state farmers are not counted in the farming population because they get a wage, or they're supposed to get a wage from the government. And state farms tend to be the ones that produce monocrops for use by the other by other farms, produce seeds, or they produce fruit, so they need to be fed from other sources. So the farming figures that I'm giving you of 60% on average for each county actually underestimate the farming population for South Korea. And, of course, we have the exception here of Haeju. Haeju, for those of you that are familiar with the countries, you know that it's a port city situated on the DPRK's west coast. I was trying to figure out exactly how far. I thought it would be safe. It's very near. Safe to say that it's less than 100 kilometres from the South Korean border. It is, however, one of North Korea's least important ports. It handled, the figures that I last had, I think they were 1999, less than 10% of the DPRK's foreign trade compared to the major west coast port of Nampo, which is 29% of trade. And again, that figure is old. Nampo probably has a higher proportion of foreign trade these days. And the major east coast port of Chongjin, which had 24%. The berthing capacity for Haeju is pretty small, and no evidence of major upgrading. This is all relevant to my argument, because what I'm saying is that even though Haeju City is urban, unlike the other counties which are farming, more or less farming counties, it shares a big land and sea border, more or less, with South Korea. But this is a prohibitive factor in terms of expansion of market opportunities for Haeju citizens, because, of course, foreigners are surveilled in all cities in the DPRK, but in Haeju, where national security tensions are tend to be reasonably high, and because of the worry about North Korean citizens getting in a boat and just going around the corner to South Korea, pretty miserable, the local population are probably monitored. And again, this is perhaps not scientific, this is just from qualitative analysis from, I've worked in Haeju, but also talked to people that work there, so that the local population is monitored even more than most in that area. Defection by land from Haeju south is virtually impossible, and the seaport is so tightly controlled that even by sea, defection is virtually impossible. Very few foreign visitors, apart from sporadic visits by aid agencies. So not much potential for industrial development in South Hwanggae, predominance of farming, and it's not really part of major trade routes where foreigners get involved, or of border trade possibilities. The South Korean border is militarized, the port is very surveilled, it's not an important port anyway. So there are not many opportunities for the population of South Hwanggae to engage in petty or commercial trade, such as to obtain hard currency. And on the other hand, of course, it's far away from China, from the Chinese borders, so the Chinese traders are not in South Hwanggae as they are in the north. On the other hand, South Hwanggae is a fairly short driving distance from Pyongyang, and central party officials and the military are thus more easily able to exert control over the province. Unlike in the northeast, for instance, which are days' worth of driving from Pyongyang. And we've already seen that Pyongyang's not able to feed its population, yet the population of Pyongyang, going back to what you're saying, suffers the least amount of malnutrition in the country. So given the proximity of South Hwanggae to Pyongyang and the relative capacity of the government to impose control in the province, it's most likely, of course, that agricultural surpluses do go from South Hwanggae to Pyongyang, and also probably from North Hwanggae, and that there are still significant transfers into Pyongyang. So this leaves the South Hwanggae population with its relative inability to obtain food and income from markets, together with its relative insulation from foreigners and therefore access to hard currency, ending up very heavily relying on its domestic provincial food production. But when transfers are made to Pyongyang, these are not or only just able to cover the food needs of the population. And as we've seen from the malnutrition statistics, they clearly do not cover them sufficiently well. And so the argument really here, and again it's a simple argument, maybe it's too simple to be taking up your time, is that the poverty of South Hwanggae's population does not reflect poor agricultural productivity in the province. It doesn't reflect what they actually produce. South Hwanghae, in fact, has recovered relatively well from the famine years, even given the sporadic nature of fertilizer inputs and government inputs. The province has probably received the optimum, in current circumstances anyway, inputs. It's been prioritized for inputs from abroad because it is a breadbasket province. So poverty in South Hwanghae is much more a result of the lack of opportunities for South Hwanghae citizens to use the market, to use market opportunities that are available to other sectors of the population, than it is in terms of agricultural productivity. I'm not going to go through all of these research issues, but I just want to talk about North Hamgyong, because North Hamgyong tends to receive a lot of press because it's the province which borders China and from which many of the refugees or migrants or defectors go into China or have done in the past. So it's been in the news a lot. So let's have a look at North Hamgyong. North Hamgyong is a similar size population to South Hwanghae, around 2.3 million. It's got one major city, Chongjin, which is divided into, well, it's got a number of cities, but the major city is Chongjin, which is divided into six city districts. And a city district has the equivalent local government status in the DPRK as a county, and it has an additional 14 counties. And that's what it, this is what it looks like. Chongjin. And the rest, the counties. North Hamgyong, though, is a bit different from South Hwanghae, is that of its 20 counties, including the six districts of Chongjin, the average population density at 2001 was 141 persons per square kilometre. And this figure is much lower than the average population density for the counties in the DPRK at 2001, which, as I said before, is 331 persons per square kilometre. And unlike South Hwanghae, where the population is fairly evenly distributed, the counties of North Hamgyong see an uneven distribution of population. So that even if Chongjin is taken out of the equation, the spread of population density ranges from a low of 27 per square kilometre in Yonsan to 234 per square kilometre in Kimchek, by way of 59 per square kilometre in Poryong, and 127 per square kilometre in Huade. So you've got, you see this. And again, probably this is for those of you that know the country, will have a mirror, have an image in your mind of North Hamgyong, where it's incredibly mountainous, and then you've got this industrialised coastal strip to the right. But again, North Hamgyong is badly off. The population are badly off, but it's not as bad as it could be. So why? And again, I go back to use socioeconomic data for 17 of the 20 counties that I had available in 2005, amounting to 84% of North Hamgyong's population. Of these 17 counties, the average farming population was just 21% for each country, compared to 60% in South Hwanghae, leaving nearly 80% of the population of these counties to find their food from income, trade or aid. Now, the relative success, and it is relative, of course, of North Hamgyong in nutritional ranking compared to the province's lack of agricultural resources means that somehow the population did succeed, this 80% of population that is not farming, in obtaining food from outside provincial food resources. Of course, not perfectly, because there's a malnutrition rate there. But they were relatively successful compared to what the agricultural productivity ranking might indicate. Now, in North Hamgyong's case, there's no evidence of redistribution of surpluses, of cereal surpluses from other provinces to North Hamgyong. So we can count this out as a causative factor, unlike in Pyongyang, for instance. And aid, arguably, we'd have to do the maths for post-2005, much less aid gone in. But apart from the years 1999 to 2001, when there was really massive amounts of aid going into North Korea, including North Hamgyong, I don't think we can say that aid was a major factor in 2004, at least, and isn't today, certainly, in helping the population to systematically avoid starvation. But, of course, what is different about North Hamgyong and South Hwanghae is that it borders China. Seven of North Hamgyong's 14 counties border on the long border with China, but it's largely unmilitarized and therefore relatively porous. And again, many of you will have been to Yenbian and will have seen the border and see that it's just a narrow stream in places. And in the winter, like now, you can walk over it, and people do walk over it and come back and go and get food and come back. And as you know, North Hamgyong borders on China's Korean-speaking region of Yenbian, where many Chinese, not all citizens, are ethnic Koreans. The population in the northern counties of DPRK will often have relations, family relations, inside China. Chongjin itself does not border China, but is home to a Chinese consulate that looks after the interests of large numbers of Chinese traders that are active in the province. In addition, Chongjin is the country's second most important port in terms of trade volumes, but not just in terms of volumes. It has lots of different trade in that its ships regularly call into Chinese ports as well as into neighboring ports of Vladivostok in Russia and used to be Niigata in Japan. I wanted to have a check and see when was the last time they went into Niigata, but at least until a few years ago they were. And Chongjin, of course, is linked with Russia by rail and with China by road. So there is plenty of opportunity, natural opportunity, for mixing with foreigners and for entering into petty trade. But of course, there's a lot of poverty in North Hamgyong. I don't want to suggest at all that there isn't poverty. Prior to the economic breakdown and the catastrophe of the 90s, North Hamgyong's population, at least on the East Coast, made their living from the large industrial plants, including the steel and cement works in Chongjin, Kimchek and Undok, as well as by working in the mines, for instance, in Musan. And North Hamgyong's formerly privileged industrial proletariat became some of the most vulnerable because they didn't have access to any form of arable lands. And in the famine period, these are the ones that starved. These are the people that went into China. And the state, of course, lost its capacity to be able to intervene in a very serious manner to redistribute food, and in fact gave up, I think, by the 2000s. So, large parts of North Hamgyong do remain very poor, and wasting in the province continues to be high. North Hamgyong continues to be a source of unauthorized migration into China, and I think this demonstrates, as I say here, desperation. I mean, it's not an easy task, even when you're poor, to take the decision to leave your country and your family and everything that you know to go into China. And it also, of course, this fact that people from North Hamgyong still go into China demonstrates the border is still relatively open compared to, for instance, the South Korean border, which is still more or less militarized, despite the road that now goes through it because of the Kaesong ventures. So I don't want to, as I say, I really want to stress this. I'm not arguing that North Hamgyong's population is better off, is well off. I'm just saying that they're relatively better off considering what their agricultural productivity would status would tell you. And so, of course, what I'm saying here is that the reasons North Hamgyong does not fare worse in terms of the relative ranking and nutritional status is a direct consequence of the variables I identified earlier as significant in explaining economic well-being. First of all, large parts of North Hamgyong are open to trade and physical communication with China and other countries via land borders and via the significant local activity in shipping. The population of North Korea, therefore, does have proximity to foreigners and consequently access, not everybody, but some, to hard currency, as well as opportunities to buy and sell food and other goods. And the province also benefits from its physical distance from Pyongyang. This means that surveillance is very difficult. Road and rail links and telecommunications infrastructure are extraordinarily primitive even today, thus making it difficult for Pyongyang, not impossible, but difficult for Pyongyang to control this province in the same way that it can control South Hwanghae and the provinces that are nearer to it. And the difficulties, I've showed you the population density and the diverse population density in North Hamgyong, are further compounded for Pyongyang because of the relatively dispersed nature of the population in the counties. And again, for those of you who travel through there and been up there, you'll know that the roads are absolutely atrocious. And in the winter, when it's like this and there's nothing working, then it's almost impossible to get from A to B for quite long periods of time. And finally, I talked about this right at the beginning, legitimacy to some extent is provided to the freelance marketization that's taken place by provincial and county party leaders. I've talked about this elsewhere in other work that I've done, who draw on the party's old philosophy of self-reliance or duce to justify entrepreneurial activity which takes place both within Northamptonshire and across the border. And again, this is not a linear process, and occasionally you'll have crackdowns on people doing things and opening ups on people doing things, but nevertheless there has been a sea change in what has been deemed acceptable in terms of market behaviour over the past 10 years. So again, the poverty of North Hamgyong's population does of course partly reflect the agricultural productivity of the province, but the fact that North Hamgyong's population is not even worse off is due to the market opportunities that the population is able to use because of the difficulties for Pyongyang in exerting political controls in this province. I'm not going to go into looking at South Hamgyong, although I have in the paper, because I just thought I'm taking up far too much time anyway. But again, South Hamgyong has better agricultural productivity than North Hamgyong, but is consistently the worst off province. And one of the reasons, of course, and I've been through it now and done it to death probably, is that there are less market opportunities. The port city of Hamhung and Hung Nam doesn't have diverse trade. It tends to be fertilizer and chemicals. This port is in good times had less foreign trade than the Chongjin and Nampo, and now today, although I haven't got current figures, I'd imagine it's even less than the 10% of foreign trade that it had before. So it's not a thriving entrepot where dock workers and restaurant workers and hotel workers and prostitutes and everybody else who mixes with foreigners can make a bit of money. So finally, market opportunity poverty in the provinces. So what I've done, I've tried to do, is to use nutritional status as a proxy for poverty indicators. And I feel in the case of the DPRK, where food is so important, and where our whole concern for the international community has really started from famine and continues with the possibility still of famine and still of continuing malnutrition, is arguably a very valid nutritional indicator. What I've tried to do, and again it sounds simple, but as far as I know, it hasn't been done before, I've shown the relative deprivation between provinces in the DPRK is not a function of their relative agricultural productivity, but is instead the outcome of the relationship between comparative advantage, including the agricultural productivity. And I go on in the paper to talk about the comparative advantage as well being to do with past and historic political relationships with Pyongyang, but that's something else I want to talk about here, otherwise we've gone forever, and market opportunity. So there's a relationship between comparative advantage and market opportunity, which I think we need to look at to explain poverty in the DPRK and non-poverty, if we can find that. So I've used this framework to explain the research puzzles that I've talked about, the nutritional status of South Hamgyong, North Hamgyong, and South Hamgyong. So what's the implications for policymakers? Well, of course, an obvious one, but it needs to be restated, you know, from left, right, or middle, that market opportunities need to be encouraged and supported by external interlocutors that are trying to engage in supporting economic change in the DPRK, whether it's through the six-party working groups when we're talking about economic issues, or whether it's through general interaction at any level. I don't mean illicit market opportunities like paying to get a visa to go into Pyongyang or whatever, which used to happen, but I mean proper market activities need to be encouraged, training and technical assistance, for instance. And another perhaps counterintuitive conclusion is that perhaps in a continuing environment of scarce resources and very large needs, continuing needs for assistance, humanitarian policy, and this is sort of, I might as well throw in something controversial, needs to be redirected towards the agriculturally productive provinces and away from others. This would be contrary, of course, to much of humanitarian policymaking, not all, but much over the last several years. But in any case, I think I would like to say that agricultural productivity should cease to be, if it is, maybe I'm wrong, the major indicator of humanitarian need in North Korea. And that's it, folks, as Tom and Jerry used to say.
Somebody asked Brendan to come in. Hazel, before we start, would you address something that jumped out at me from what you said? And that was the... Can you hear me? That was that the distance from Pyongyang along the northern border, the farther you are from Pyongyang, the better off you are. Now, can you elaborate upon that? Because that would indicate that the influence of Pyongyang is a negative, malignant.
Yeah.
Now, is that generally true, or is that just more particularly true in the examples that you were giving?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because what I wanted to do, as I think is indicated by the work on population density, was to have a look as a key variable as to how much Pyongyang could control what was going on outside Pyongyang in terms of the distance from Pyongyang. And I don't think I can say much more from this data, from the data that I've given you about distance from Pyongyang. I can say some, make some judgments about population density and how I think that refers to my one of the theses, which is that the more Pyongyang has the ability to surveil and control, the less good it is for the population in terms of their ability to engage in market opportunities. But I don't want to overdo what I can get from this data. But if you were to ask me for what I get from this data plus my previous research, I think that, yes, that what Pyongyang has tried to do in terms of economic redevelopment and encouraging some form of reform is to control that marketization which I've talked about in a way which is counterproductive for a real process of market reform. And I don't think it's been able to do so in some of these provinces, in North Hamgyong, for instance, and in parts of the other provinces. But I think it hasn't given up on the attempt to do so. I don't know whether malign would be the right word, because I think there's lots of good bureaucrats working in the Ministry of Foreign Trade that do want to see some form of regulated capitalism operating in the DPRK. But I think given the various strands that operate on policymaking in the DPRK, the strength of what I would call almost generically the security apparatus, and however one might define that, is such that that still wants to put the dead hand on individuals spontaneously engaging in market relations and in developing any form of private enterprise which is truly separated from the state. So I wouldn't say malign, but I would say where there is less surveillance possible from Pyongyang, and I think what this small piece of research shows is that that's probably borne out as well, then there are more, it is healthier economically for the citizens. And certainly in the case of South Hwanghae, I can't imagine that South Hwanghae's farming population would be voluntarily sending its surpluses to Pyongyang. And I don't think they are sending them all anyway. I think they're selling some on the market. But they would be selling more on the market if they'd had less surveillance.
I assume you're okay for a few more questions, even though we're past the time. Good. I'm not sure who was first. We'll take Lee, but I believe you were first, I think. The mic is behind you.
I'm Melanie Kirkpatrick from the Wall Street Journal. Two questions. One, could you elaborate a little bit about whether there is the development of a private agricultural sector that's separate from the state? And two, you often hear that food goes to the military first. Do your data support that or not?
So military first. Sorry, and the first question again was?
The development of private.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I don't think there's any secret that the priority is to feed the army. The families don't get fed, but the million or so that are in service get fed. The government have said that, they often say what they mean. And I've no doubt at all that the first call on the harvest goes to the military. also the bilateral aid from South Korea and from China, because it's bilateral, the government can do what it likes with it. And this happens with all countries, not just with North Korea. If you give bilateral aid to a government, whether it's in the form of food or economic support, the government chooses its own priorities and allocates the aid according to those priorities. And there's no doubt that in the DPRK, there is still a national security mentality. We're not in the stage yet of the six-party talks where we've got demobilization of the troops, although I hope that that will come at some point. Until we get there, they are going to have to feed that military. And actually, China and South Korea want the military to be fed because the last thing they want is roaming troops on borders that are hungry and desperate. So I think that quantitative data to show that the military get fed first. I think that that's true. It's not something to be demonstrated. It's simply true. It will come from the harvest and it will come from bilateral aid. But we do have evidence that they don't get fed a lot. And the evidence for that is that we've had North Korean soldiers robbing banks in China, in Yenbian, because they've been desperate. And also we've had lots of anecdotal evidence, qualitative evidence, which overall talks about families grumbling that their children are in the army. They don't want them to be in the army anymore. They used to, because that was the way to get a good education and to be fed properly and to get status in society. Now North Koreans want their children to be traders because there is a nouveau riche that's grown up in the DPRK, which is a visible nouveau riche, with access to videos and flat-screen televisions and sometimes second-hand Japanese cars that have come into the country. And these are the people that are eating this new class that's made some money from trading. So we know that the status of the military isn't good, and we know that their families have to find food. And that's not surprising either, because it is a million or so people in the army, and if you fed all their families, you'd be feeding 6 million people, and you would need to have a non-food crisis to be able to do that. So I think that that's clear. In terms of, is there a private sector in agriculture? There's no doubt that farmers, where they can, are selling surplus on markets. And that's what comes down to the issue of differential in the country, in terms of where the government has been able to continue to exert its control and where it has not. And it looks like from these figures, and again, before I started comparing the data that we have available to us, I certainly wasn't in any way sure about this. My feeling was, prior to doing this undertaking, to be straightforward, and I've written about this and I've put it on paper before, and I think I was wrong, was that there was more marketization that had taken place in the south of the country than I find from this. What these figures show to me is that the government is still able to take surpluses, considerable surpluses, from the breadbasket provinces, has been able to regain control there and take the surpluses into Pyongyang. But what it's not able to do is to redistribute throughout the country. Well, there's not enough food production for a start. The overall context of this is North Korea doesn't provide enough food to feed its population. Even if it was all distributed perfectly, there is still food availability problems, and food still has to come in from South Korea in terms of aid. But in terms of an open private sector in grain purchasing, buying and selling privately is illegal in North Korea. And at times, the government will clamp down on it, and at times it will allow it. And again, this comes down to provincial and sometimes county differentiation. When the provinces and the county leaders are prepared to turn a blind eye to it because they think that this will, you know, facilitate food distribution in their areas, and when those areas are further away from Pyongyang, you're more likely to see farmers involved in private markets, because they've got the ability to do so and because they can make money by doing so. And the whole ethos in North Korea these days is not to serve the state, but it's to make money. I mean, there is still an egalitarian basis foundation, and so you find doctors and nurses and teachers working for next to nothing throughout the country. But nevertheless, there is no longer an idea that you work for the glory of the great leader, despite what people might say to visiting delegations. It's about making money. And so that itself is constrained by opportunity, by what I've called market opportunity. And where the counties and the provinces, the party leaderships, at least are tolerant of that sort of activity, then it takes place. And when the government in my view, given the research I've done, when the government is able and perhaps desperate enough to intervene, as it must feed the population in Pyongyang, otherwise everybody will see that the country's falling to bits, then it will displace market activity. But if the question is the country really turning towards a situation where the market could flourish if there were suitable regulations and incentives and a government that would allow it, I think the answer is yes. I think people are ready for the market in DPRK.
Okay. Lee, you're next, I guess. It's Lee Siegel from the Social Science Research Council.
You never specifically mentioned the public distribution center, the system. And so my assumption is when you're talking about the state essentially robbing from the poor, South Hwangye, and giving to the rich, Pyongyang, that is the main function at this point of the public distribution system. Could you describe its operation anywhere else? Is it apparent that it is providing any food anywhere else in significant quantities? What's our sense of this? And when they talk now about restoring it, what would that mean?
Well, I can talk about the public distribution system up until 2003. I realize this is something that I would need to look at in distribution mechanisms. And certainly till 2001, when I was working in Pyongyang up till 2001, a lot of the old public distribution centers, the physical centers, had been physically closed down because they weren't in use. Because what happened was that if any food came into the system, it went out straight away. Or the food that was coming from World Food Program, which was the most of the food, was distributed through warehouses but straight to institutions. So the public distribution centers were, in the way the system worked in the past, the distribution centres for adults and for families, for the family ration. Well, from the mid-1990s, well, through till now, there is no continuing family ration. It doesn't function. Or it didn't function until 2003. And I have seen no evidence to suggest it's taken on a life of its own since 2003. I have been in public distribution centres, old ones, that were converted even at that time in 2001 into schools or extra nursery classes because they weren't being used. The public distribution system, there's two things. One is the public distribution system, which is a software system, which used to operate on the basis basically of occupation, as you know, and age, so that you received a ration based on a mixture of occupation and age. This was changed in the famine, so when food was available in the system, there was a flat rate, something like 300 grams a day. And it was changed again because there was never enough food in the population, so it's priority groups at different periods. So, for instance, if you're a miner in Musan and the county wanted to keep the coal coming out of the ground, then what food was available, probably even from the international organizations when it should have been going to children, was directed by the county authorities to the priority group at that time. All the evidence that I can see indicates that it's that system that continues. So the public distribution system, in the sense that it used to operate, so that it was a guaranteed minimum ration for all social groups, depending upon classification regarding to age and occupation, no longer exists. Even welfare food no longer exists. But when food comes in the system at particular times, the counties distribute the food to the local priority groups at a particular time. So in that sense, the system hasn't disintegrated, but it's changed its function.
Sorry.
Hi, my name is Eunice. I go to the same school as she does. I have a question about small foreign NGOs in each provinces. I emailed Mr. Peter back regarding the list of the NGOs currently working in North Korea, and he emailed me back saying that it's impossible for him or other people to know exactly how many NGOs are currently working in North Korea, partly because there's bad coordination among NGOs, and secondly, because they are being careful on each other. And recently, last summer, I went to North Korea with a small Korean-American organization who are working only in one specific province. And you showed us the analysis of the health conditions, you know, the nutritional status of the children. And I read your book, but I could not find whether this analysis includes the works and interactions that these small, very small micro-level NGOs are putting into North Korea. And it's, if it's not out there, the information is not out there right now, is it intentionally not out there, or is it just too early to have small NGOs come together with the international big organizations to work together?
That's a good question. There have always been NGOs, well, always been, since the mid-1990s, NGOs that are resident in DPRK, a small number, about 13 or 14 till a few years ago, now that's five or six, but many, many more from all over the world, including Japan, South Korea, UK, Europe, everywhere, Australia, that have gone in to visit, usually taken a bit of aid and come out again. Sometimes they maintain a relationship, sometimes they don't. So it's an extremely fluid sets of relationships there. I and others have made some attempts at some periods in time to document who's been in and who's been out. I don't think it's I think there is competition. I mean, it's clear there's competition between NGOs for access to the DPRK, but that's not unusual in the NGO world. NGOs have to compete for funding from governments and from wherever else. But I don't think it's malevolent, actually, in terms of lack of sharing of information. I think it's not a priority for NGOs that are having a hard enough time finding money to send assistance. What was helpful a few years ago, and I wished that, where's Victor? Victor would be the one to do this. It'd be great if they were reinstituted. There were three international conferences that took place, one in Beijing, one in Seoul, and one in Tokyo, between the periods in 98 and 2001, something like that, of organized by the NGOs, some of the big NGOs like Mercy Corps, where everybody who was working on DPRK from anywhere in the world could come along and give papers and say what they were doing. And there was information sharing. You had the big ones, you had the small ones. Apart from the NGOs, the UN organizations went, some of the bilaterals went, like the Swiss. And so there was a lot of sharing of information. But that takes money to organize, of course. So I think it's a question just of somebody doing it and bringing it all together. I don't think it's malevolent. Of course, there's competition for resources, but I don't think it's malevolent. I just think that it's a big organizational job to do that, actually.
Okay, so you want to take one last question? And it's just about the time. So, Henry, as one of our most faithful participants, he certainly deserves a question.
Henry Segerman, International Investment Advisors. Well, thank you for coming, and it's really refreshing to have someone here who's so close to the situation in the right on the ground, specifically on the ground. Question: if you could tell George Bush and Kim Jong-il exactly what to do to end starvation in North Korea, what would you tell them? Are there examples of starvation and malnutrition being ended elsewhere in the emerging world, China, India, Brazil, anywhere else that you can point to for a rapid solution to a terrible problem that we see in North Korea?
Well, that's a very big question, and maybe I should be addressing it to, you know, Senator Obama or Senator McCain, or who knows. But I think the answer is that China has done very well. China is the unsung, I think, hero in terms of nutrition over the past 10 or 15 years. Its malnutrition rates are well below India, Pakistan, the big democracies of Asia. And China is a country which North Korea doesn't feel too threatened by. So there's really two ways to answer it if you're a policymaker. One is that, well, the broad answer is you need a change in government in the DPRK. So the question is, how do you get there? Do you have regime change? My feeling is that if you have regime change by whatever means, it doesn't actually necessarily help North Koreans. You could have lots of starving North Koreans after regime change, and lots of starving South Koreans if the conflict went south, and lots of starving Chinese. So I think my view is that one can't get away from patient negotiation, which the South Koreans, I think, showed starting in 2000, which Japan has shown with the abductees, with Mr. Koizumi, and now perhaps continuing, who knows, with this new administration. And I think Chris Hill has done a magnificent job. And as I was saying before this meeting, Chris Hill, to me, and the job that he's done in the negotiations over the past year, the lack of recognition for how he's changed the arena reminds me of the lack of immediate recognition that was given to the summit between Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il back in 2000, and which proved to have changed the negotiating arena between South and North Korea for good. I don't know if the changes between the United States and the DPRK are so embedded now, but I do think that there is a chance for serious discussion on both sides. North Korea is an authoritarian state with a lot of poor people, and it's got a national security mentality. But on the other hand, it's more pragmatic than people have given it credit for. It's a perfectly rational actor in terms of its negotiations. So my advice would be a Helsinki-type process for what, you know, who cares about my advice, but given you've asked me, I've got the chance. It's a Helsinki-type process. Security in one basket. Keep on. These issues are important. Missiles, nuclear bombs are important. Economic development and humanitarian aid in the other basket, and human rights in the other basket. Not to forget human rights, but not to make progress on one conditional on progress on the other, because then you have paralysis. And it's engagement, while being very clear about what the overall objectives are, which I think are to achieve in the end. Sounds platitudinous, but nevertheless, so what? They're good goals: prosperity, peace, and freedom throughout the whole peninsula.
Once again, Hazel, thank you so much. I think this is maybe the third time you've been with us, and I'm always amazed at how you're continuing to develop your knowledge about what the facts are on the ground. And I don't know what drove of data you got your hands into in order to do this, and maybe. Maybe you don't want us to know either, but I see. So it's wonderful to have, as Henry said, such a really on the ground kind of a sense of what the situation in North Korea is, and your obvious compassion for the situation that confronts ordinary North Koreans. And yet an awareness that in order for us to get to the answer to the question that Henry posed, we really probably have a long route that may seem circuitous, but I think most people, or many people who have followed these issues closely, would absolutely agree with you that we've got to keep working on all fronts simultaneously, and there isn't any necessarily... silver bullet that's going to get us to the end that we all are seeking, which is an engagement of the re-involvement, the re-engagement of North Korea into the community of nations, which I think is the best way to solve all these long-term problems. So thank you very much for coming. Hope to see you all again. If you're not a member of the Korea Society, do consider sharing some of your wealth with us. And we will keep you informed about future programs.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Journal. Membership may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.